And the Oscar for Best Podcast goes to this podcast. Before we continue my first ever journey through the Harry Potter series, just a few quick announcements. First, the Potterless Los Angeles live show is sold out. I'm very excited to perform there. I'm sorry that we could not get a larger venue to see more faces. Hopefully we'll be back in the near future. But there will be some more Potterless live show announcements coming soon. I will be unveiling them in the coming weeks. If you want to stay up to date with all information about seeing Potterless live in the human flesh, you can go to multitude.productions/live. Also, I added new audio clips to the Patreon for the first time in a very long time. I've done some bloopers and little extras, some things that were recorded either before, after, during episodes that didn't make the cut have been put onto the Patreon. So if you want to check those out, go on over to patreon.com/potterless. And speaking of the Patreon, we have new patrons to welcome to the team. So shout out to Erica Weinberg, Ashley Stibe, Arius Jax, Bridget Mutton, Colleen Waters, Paige Mitchell, Giorgio, Delkis, Georgia Ferry, Brianna, Julia, Julie Yagmar Varal, Milo Duncan, Andrea Cocklemeyer, Jay Fowler, Johanna Svensson, and Brandon Garner. A name correction for Iona Gilbreth and Julia Buskamp. Shout out to Tilde Jonesson and David Kirkpatrick, who upgraded their pledge, and a huge shout out to our new producer level patron, Okami Hime. They joined the ranks of Vicky Aaron, Jesse Clow, Marchismo, Samantha Juan, Rose Marie, Maria Lisa, Romina, Audra, Eleanor, Rossanne, Nikita, Ali, Amelia, Sarah, Ben, Rachel, Zachary, Orchid, Vivian, Takari, Haley, Mooster, Ingen, Alex, John, Noel, Emily, Liz, Brandon, Sarah, Claire, Rory, Gloria, Veronica, Lada, Noah, Tracy, Colleen, Jennifer, Friday, Ivor, Naomi, Summer, Andrea, Lynn, Justin, Christine, Jacob, Toothless, Maya, Mark, Polly, Netta, Zena, Harlan, Noelia, Addie, Nikki, Kine, Amanda, Alicia, Kafir, Lindy, Sarah, Marta, Erin, Eileen, Violet, Lindsay, Keegan, Miranda, Gail Ann, Mr. Folk, Maya, Kieran, Lily, Wire Warrior, Floor, Siri, Georgia, Peter, Skyla, Adele, Professor Threat, Ellie, Daniel, Lee, Lily, Elizabeth, Michael, Tiffany, Kelly, Carrie, Connie, Mary, Jennifer, Jaden, Nedry, Will, Samantha, Kayla, Aurora, Emma, Out of Context, Marcos, Hannah, Courtney, Victoria, Marique, Ashton, Brittany, Phelan, Julie, The Meadows Family, Ginny, Anna, Fake, Brianna, Jenny, Sarah, McKenna, Mary, Joy, Heather, Dead Cat Lady, Javi, Darlene, Brad, Thomas, Charlotte, Brianna, Kevin, Lori, Chrissy, Bugaboo, Jarl, Haley, Emma, Ashley, Peta, Sophie, Jack, Jen, and Nicole, Callahan, Kylo, Leah, Melissa, Jordy, Bella, Melanie, Bill, Victoria, Joe, Elizabeth, Britt, Molly, Becca, Anthony, Rees, Adam, Madison, Kyle, Tonks, G, Sabrina, Sophia, Farzan, Melanie, David, Maria, Matt, Steamed Nuggets, and Can't I Potter? Who never turn on a blender without the top on it, preventing things from splashing all over the kitchen. If you want to be like one of these amazing patrons and get access to bonus content such as exclusive merchandise, live streams, bonus episodes, director's commentary, more, you can go to patreon.com/potterless. But without further ado, let's get into episode 112 of Potterless, the third of three parts about the seventh movie, Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows Part 1, guest starring Jonas Robinette, Martin Austwick, and Helen Zaltz. Hello, Internet, and welcome back to another episode of Potterless, the tale of a 27-year-old man who didn't read the Harry Potter books as a kid. He read them as an adult. Now he's watching the movies and talking about them with various friends. My name is Mike Schubert. I'm that grown man, and I'm here joined today by three friends, one of which is in person with me in the same room. It's Jonas, a.k.a. Joe Nasty Draws, who is an old Vine buddy
that's
now doing many other things. And across on the Internet, live from Seattle, Washington, is Helen Zaltzman and Martin Austwick. How's it going, friends?
Hi.
Very well.
All right. Yeah. This is going to be the third and final part about this movie.
You say final now, but let's see how long this goes.
Not if we could help it.
No, we're going to do it because it's late.
It is.
So let's get right into it. We left off with Scabior's grand entrance, but beyond that, we have Ron being all moody and brooding.
Yes.
So Ron is making a whole big stink, mainly because he's got the Horcrux around his neck, but he's making a whole big stink about Harry and Hermione seeming to be getting along and solving the mystery of Horcruxes together.
Oh, this is so tedious.
I will say Rupert is convincing.
You say it is convincing.
Oh, did you not think it was?
Oh, I thought it was such bollocks. I was just like, they've got to a point in the plot, they need to engineer some kind of conflict. And it's like, there's no chemistry with Harry and Hermione.
I think there is a bit. I think they've got a kind of friends with benefits chemistry. Whereas Harry with Ginny, there's like fuck all chemistry there. No. That is like two glove puppets having to get it on. And then Ron and Hermione, that just seems like both of them are grossed out by the whole idea.
Also, like, it's taking this very, very, very Lord of the Rings concept of like, I've got a thing hanging around my neck and it's turning me evil and making me hate my friends, my precious. And it's also like, I know like she draws on like other fantasy stories, but this is a point where I'm just like, come on, JK, come up with your own idea at this point.
I will say that something one of my VFX instructors had said is like, there are really no original stories left in the world. Like, you can really see a lot of concepts in movies that are taken from other movies, stuff like that.
Well, yeah, but I think there's you know, you at least try.
what never made sense to me about the Horcrux is you have this magical bag from Hermione. Just put the Horcrux in the bag.
Right.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Why do they have to wear it? Hey, editing Mike here. Here's something that I didn't mention at the time of recording, but I still believe holds true. I can see why putting it in Hermione's bag of holding can be hard because it's so big and there's a bunch of stuff in there. But I don't understand why they didn't put the Horcrux in the little pouch that Hagrid gave to Harry. It seems like the perfect place to keep it safe without having to wear the Horcrux. I will never understand why they didn't do this. Anyway, back to the podcast.
Maybe it would like turn the other objects evil. So like the tent would come out and it would be really gothic. It would just be like black velvet drapes.
Now I have evil jeans.
But then it would look kick ass.
Oh yeah, evil jeans, they'd be like really tight fitting and they'd become black and made out of leather instead of denim.
Oh yeah.
I got evil jeans now.
I'm bad Janet.
I will say that I felt like Ron could take Harry.
Oh yeah, he's much bigger than him.
Yeah.
In the book and in real life, because Daniel Radcliffe is a tiny stick. Boy.
Yeah. But also, like, isn't Ron injured? Like, would it make any sense for them to go like, well, we're gonna share the Horcrux around, but Ron, who's just gone through like bit of his shoulder being missing, why don't we give it him for like a whole day and then just fuck off and leave him on his own?
Like, he's feeling like shit anyway because of the splinching, so why not compound it?
I feel like he wears it the longest,
right? Like, they're aware that the Horcrux turns you into a bit of a cunt, so like why would you like just go, oh yeah, we'll just leave one on his own for like 4 or 5 hours, I'm sure it'll be fine.
But we never see anyone else like react that way. We just see Ron slowly.
There's one of the first times early on Harry does it.
Yeah,
but
Harry's really grumpy.
The most dramatic is Ron.
Yeah.
But like Ron's vulnerable. You'd think they would factor that in.
Yeah.
It just feels like a way to go, like, we need something to split these characters apart so they can come back together again later. And that annoys the shit out of me.
I think you're right there, Martin. I think that the way at which they arrive at it is too quick and not as logical and laid out as it is in the books. Right, but I think what I was trying to more say is that I think that Rupert Grint plays a convincing, pissed off teenager.
Yeah, he does. Yeah.
Like very, oh, I'm mad at you, even though my reasons don't make much sense, but I'm sticking to my guns.
Yeah.
This is puberty.
Yeah. I'm going through a lot of changes. So you get this scene where Hermione is cutting Harry's hair, and then Hermione has an epiphany about the Sword of Gryffindor. But the best is if you go to 1 hour and 15 minutes into the film, when Hermione says, oh my God, and is realize it, the way that Harry says what is so funny. It's just like this weird monotone, what? And I've recorded it and I will play it out loud over the microphone for everyone to hear, but I think it's just so funny.
Oh my God.
What?
What?
Just
what?
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 Sounds like a Lobot.
Just no emotion, no tone. What?
Well, also, like, it's so apropos of nothing. I feel like he's thinking, like, has she just like stabbed her scissors into a part of my head that I just haven't noticed? She's gonna go like, oh, I found an extra face.
And if you watch the scene in the movie too, his face is also equally deadpan, so it's just this perfect what.
I think those are one of the days that he was drunk. Apparently, Daniel Radcliffe was drunk a lot on set.
Oh, really?
That's what he said.
Oh.
When he was a kid, he was drinking. Wow, have you never talked about this?
I have not.
That's pretty grim, isn't
Daniel, it? Daniel, has it been on the show, the coward?
Daniel, reveal yourself.
Come on the show.
I mean, that scene didn't play out very well. Their acting was kind of soft that day.
Yeah, not super great. Because then they go over to the table and Hermione recognizes the whole sort of Gryffindor thing and where it's going to be and all this other stuff. It's Goblin Maid, blah, 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 blah. And then Harry says, you're brilliant, Hermione, truly. And then Hermione's response is so awkward that it makes me want to crawl into a ball and never leave a cocoon of blankets. She goes, actually, I'm highly logical, which allows me to look past extraneous detail and perceive clearly that which others overlook.
It's like, all right, Spock, Jesus Christ, just take a fucking compliment.
Look at my word salad of long words with many syllables in it. I'm Hermione, I'm smart. Kill me. Oh, I hated this so much.
It's really not believable, is it? It's like, she is, in other respects, like a normal 17-year-old girl. And that she'd do like a full like Leonard Nimoy on him is just like, no.
Very non-playable character kind of quotes right there.
This seems like she would have had this pre-rehearsed. She thought of this in the shower one time. Yeah. If someone ever says I'm brilliant, I'm going to say this and it's going to sound cool.
I feel like she's going to follow up the line with like, I need you to go and kill 20 hogs in that field over there. Then return to me when you have them get those skins. I will give you a sword.
So immediately after this, you get Ron being very upset about Harry and Hermione. And I Again, think that when Ron and Harry in this movie get into arguments, it's very convincing.
Yeah.
It's a very convincing teenage boy argument, and I really enjoyed it, just in the sense of it felt real.
And it's also convincing for camping.
Yes.
Because a bad night's sleep makes you into like the worst person, even if you're not wearing a kind of Lord of the Rings thing.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Especially with Ron also listening to this radio station that he is worried about his family. It's really building up in him.
Yeah.
It's like one of those moments where you get into an argument, you wanted to say one thing, but you never got a chance to, and it's building in you forever, and you're just like, well, I could have said this.
It's funny the way that they phrase what Ron brings up in this argument, though, because I think it's a rare instance where the movie makes him look more profound than the book does. Because in the book, one of the major points of Ron being upset is that he's hungry.
Yeah, where are they getting their food from?
They don't really talk about it in this movie. In the book, there's little things where they're making stuff out of cans, and they steal things from a town once, like they steal from a farm. And
good
and
luck
all
with
that. So they don't really show much of it here. They like forage for mushrooms and berries.
It's like naked and afraid, but clothed.
But they change Ron's argument here to not focus on him being hungry and not eating a real meal, which I think was a smart decision to make him look a little bit, make him seem less like a diva.
Yeah. I did just think, like, what does she see in him in this scene? He's kind of petty. He's insecure. He's not super smart. Like, it's not like he's a complex, conflicted person. He's just a bit of a dumbass. He just flies off the handle about this stuff. Like, why is she into him?
This is a problem with the movie's adaptation of Ron, is that in the books, Ron is this nice foil to Hermione, where Hermione is really smart and calculated. Ron is a bit more impulsive. Mm. Hermione is a bit too high strung, and Ron is chill to a fault at times.
Right.
And they kind of play off each other, nice opposites attract, yin and the yang type thing.
Right,
in the movie,
right.
A lot of Ron's competent elements and competent moments get shifted onto other characters. Like, they get passed on to Harry, or they get passed on to Hermione. So in the movie, it doesn't make as much sense.
Well, they happen off screen like they did earlier in this movie where he saved someone and you just told about it.
Do you think Rupert Grint pissed off David Yates or something so he doesn't get any of the cool Ron moments?
Here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to make your character look not as great. But I guess in this scene specifically, and Hermione says this, is she's trying to give him the benefit of the doubt that it's not really how he feels. It's just the Horcrux talking. And she believes that if he would just take it off, he wouldn't be saying all these things, but he refuses to. And then by the time he does take it off, he's already on his way out. So it's too late.
Yeah. I just feel like when Harry took off the Horcrux, he immediately chilled out. Whereas that doesn't happen with Ron. And again, it's just like, you just track the writing is trying to create this tension.
Maybe he's not just pissed off because of the Horcrux.
Yeah, but it's a part of it, and it would at least take it down a few notches where he was like, oh, okay, look, I'm just going to go for a walk and come back, and then we'll talk about it, rather than I'm going to fuck off completely.
Maybe it's because of his vulnerability and the length of how he was wearing it.
Right, right.
Like, the effects lasted a little bit longer, because he did say, after I left, I wanted to come back.
Yeah. They talk about in the book that Ron is particularly susceptible to it because he's a little more insecure of himself. But I think Jonas makes a good point, too, is that he had it on for the whole day. So maybe it took him more than just
that was such 10 a stupid
seconds
move.
For him to snap back to reality. Oh, there goes gravity.
I mean, that is on Harry and Hermione. They weren't really looking after him, letting him carry that all day.
100%. They should have been more on top of the game and be like, oh, I haven't worn the death necklace in a little bit. Let me put that on.
It's my turn on the death necklace.
So Ron leaves in a tiff, etc. But then you get Harry trying to cheer Hermione up with the interesting dance scene, which I have talked about before with my sister, because she tried to make the point, oh no, it's not a weird romantic thing. This is just, you know, like a brother-sister type friendship thing. And I said, Megan, when have we ever done this? Yes. And she said, never mind.
It's a friends with benefits scene. They are dancing like dorks, but dancing to Nick Cave music in these kind of emotionally heightened circumstances, it seemed heady to me.
Yeah.
If Hermione had gotten a little bit closer, rested her head on his shoulder, and they kissed, I'm pretty sure Harry would not mind at all.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that that's his intention. I think he's just trying to...
It's not, but...
But there is that intimacy between them that it's not a brother-sister thing.
Yeah, it feels a little bit more. Yeah. I don't know if there's a way to do something that is sillier, but I don't know that partner dancing is necessarily the thing.
Could use a more upbeat song.
Yeah.
I thought it was a lovely scene. I've never seen someone dance to a Nick Cave song in a film. Our first dance at our wedding was to a Nick Cave song. So I guess I liked the scene a little more than I would otherwise.
Really jolly. But I wonder whether they're just kind of substitutes for each other. Because the person they wish was there is not there.
They're both lonely and it's a very stressful situation.
They're fucking bored.
Yeah. Kind of their friend, you know, their only other friend is just fucked off.
I think it makes sense. Like, they're all they've got. They're trying to cheer each other up and get their minds off of it. I just think that the choice of activity is a bit strange.
Yeah. Mm.
I think that the intention is correct, but the decision of partner dancing is like, maybe we could have done something
else. Some chess.
You think they could have done some line dancing? Like, can you do line dancing with two people?
Oh, yeah. They could have done the wobble.
I think it would have been like in Girls, they crank up Dancing on My Own by Robin, and it's just one of them dancing, the other one comes in and joins in. But they're both solo dancing together.
Like a silent disco.
Exactly.
I think if it wasn't partner dancing, but instead if they played some ballad, like if they played some sort of power ballad from the 80s.
Yeah.
Like if they put on Total Eclipse of the Heart and they're just like, turn around.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah, can't complain. Nice. But especially because it is the late 90s and that would probably be a radio hit of choice. Like, how much radio airplay was Nick Cave getting on any radio station in the UK in 1998?
I don't know.
We could not tell you.
What album was 1998?
Well, it was after Murder Ballads. Those did get a lot of airplay.
Yeah, so the Wild Roses Grow was on British radio quite a lot.
They could have tried to, like, lip sync to Wild Roses Grow. She could have done the Kylie vocal.
I mean, that's not a very danceable song, given that Kylie Minogue dies in that song.
But that seems appropriate because they're avoiding death throughout this. Where are they at this point? Are they in the Forest of Dean, where she's like, my parents took me camping?
So
this was interesting to me for a couple of reasons. Firstly, the Forest of Dean is full of tiny wild ponies.
Oh, in real life?
Yes, and that would have been cool.
Oh, no.
Secondly, do you feel like Hermione is just going around looking for traces of her old family life just for herself?
I feel like she is, because there's a lot of moments where she's just like, I remember when my parents took me here. I went to this street back in the day with my parents, and she's just like really kind of stick with his family. Does she go back to her family after this, or is that
they're brainwiped?
Explain.
Assume they can't unbrainwipe.
You can't unbrainwipe that.
I don't know.
I am very happy to report that Spice, the album from Spice Girls, came out in 1996, so they could have
danced to Wannabe.
Sang and dance along to Wannabe.
Well, 1998, they could have danced along to whatever Spice Girls album that was, with like Goodbye on it.
Yeah, 1997, Spice World came out, so there's a full discography of Spice Girls out there for them.
In the bag, she could have a TV and VCR, and they could have watched Spice World on video.
That would have been a nice bonding exercise.
I mean, I would have loved to see Daniel Radcliffe lip-syncing along to Mel B's rap verse of, well, here's the story from A to Z.
Oh, I bet Daniel Radcliffe would also love that.
Yeah, scientifically proven to be the most addicting song.
Oh, really?
Yes.
I mean, it's super good.
Yeah. Well, actually, so the Nick Cave album that came out in 1997 was The Boatman's Call. So they could have danced to Into My Arms, which was our first dance at our wedding.
Oh.
But they chose not to, the wankers.
How dare they?
Was this song written especially for the film, or is it a Nick Cave song? Anyway, dwelling too much.
Yeah, it couldn't have been for the film. I do think this is a missed opportunity for them to introduce Celestina Warbeck, who is a canon musician that is in the books. I think it would have been fun if they wrote and performed a song for them to dance to, and then the radio broadcaster could have been like, that was Celestina Warbeck's A Cauldron Full of Hot Love.
Yeah, but I bet it would have been
is
like...
Is that a real name of a song?
It's a cauldron. It's something, it's like a hot cauldron full of love or something. She's got a whole discography.
That is a great name of a song.
I just think that J.K. Rowling trying to write a song that is cool is just going to be the most hard cringe thing possible.
Oh, it's like in Lord of the Rings where there's like a Tom Bombadil song and everyone's like, no, Tom Bombadil, shut up.
Oh, man. Yeah, I think you're right, Helen. I don't trust J.K.'s songwriting ability.
But I really like this scene.
Yeah, I thought it was really good.
You hate it.
I don't hate it. It's just when I think about it too much, I get confused by it.
Don't think about it too much, even though I appreciate that's your job with this show, but don't. Because when you think about these things too much, then you get into a toilet entrance to a civil service building and there's no way out except up someone's butt.
Yeah, I think ultimately the biggest thing on the scene is that they're going through a lot and they need something to relieve the stress, and this works.
And they're both shit at dancing. They're much worse at dancing than they were when they danced in film 4.
They are. And that was another note. I wonder if Daniel Radcliffe is really bad at dancing, or he's playing Harry Potter incredibly well because Harry Potter, the character, would be really bad at dancing. Either way, I love
it. I feel like he'd be a more energetic dancer than this, though.
I think it's a Daniel Radcliffe.
He's got big dad dance energy vibes here.
Yes. But I feel like he'd commit more. And she's danced before in the films because they had the ball in the fourth film.
Yeah. They both danced in it. So they both should be better.
It's just I guess that scene just makes it awkward because it's just them two in a forest.
They should have been dancing to the cha-cha slide. That would have been good.
Was that out in 98?
Let's see.
What were the novelty hits in 1998? Maybe, I don't know. We'd had Scatman John by that point.
Oh, Scatman would have been amazing.
Perfect for the atmosphere.
Hey Siri, when did the cha-cha slide release?
Casper Cha-Cha Slide by Casper and the Live Platinum Band came out on the 19th of September. 2000.
Martin, is that you?
Sorry. 2 years too late. You know, they would have been dancing to a very boring Oasis track.
Oh, God, yeah.
Did Wonderwall come out?
I think that was more like 95, 96, but then they had these very turgid albums of more songs.
Like, do you know what I mean?
How would it be if instead of picking up Hermione to dance, Harry conjures a guitar?
Oh, no, and starts playing
and
Wonderwall.
And sits in the tent and goes, today's going to be the day.
Oh, they're already having a shit enough time.
I don't believe.
That's what he would do if he was wearing the locket.
Yeah, if he wears the locket, he pulls out the guitar and plays Wonderwall.
Very emo.
So apparently the Nick Cave song is called O Children and appears on his 2004 album The Lyre of Orpheus / Abattoir Blues. It's anachronistic, wasn't even released. I guess magic.
It's a song from the future.
Yeah, it does, with the Determinator that she has in one of the movies.
Maybe it was an unreleased demo.
Oh, bad news. Coldplay were formed in 1996, so there's a danger that it could have been a Coldplay song.
They weren't getting
song.
Airplay till 2000, Martin.
Were they not?
Can confidently say.
Wait, when was Shiver?
Stop it.
Sorry.
Harry then later on has the snitch and he's trying to figure out how to make it work. And the scene of him realizing and then slowly putting it up to his mouth is so funny. I thought it was really well done, where he's caught between thinking, I should do this. I shouldn't do this. I think I should do this. No, this is bad. Oh, it's so wonderfully done. I love it. Just the sheer nature of, we got to try everything here, guys. Let me put this snitch in my mouth. And
also,
it works.
You've got to be super bored, right?
Yeah, they've got nothing to do. What'd you do today? I tried eating the snitch and it told me that I opened it to close. I thought it was a Ferrero Rocher.
I mean, it does look like one.
They're all going to be giddy with hunger. Everything's going to start looking like a Ferrero Rocher. Mm. Like deer droppings, stones.
Why haven't they made that?
Yeah. How has there not been a Ferrero Rocher Harry Potter crossover where they have snitch Ferrero Rochers?
Hmm.
Warner Brothers, whoever makes Ferrero Rocher, delete half of the R's in your candy's name. And second, partner up with Warner Brothers.
And give us 10%.
10%. That's all we need.
Well, aim higher. 90%. Treat yourself.
Thank you.
So Harry tries to put the snitch in his mouth, goes over to Hermione and explains it. And I realized at this point that this movie not having the narrator is rough. They do a pretty good job of using aha and eureka moments to explain all of these realizations, which is still how it goes down in the books. But because you have a narrator, you get a little bit more of build up to them figuring it out. Whereas it just feels like in this movie, every 15 minutes, somebody goes, oh, shit, I got it. Yo, Hermione. And it just happens every 15 to 20 minutes. So he goes over, tells her that he's figured it out, and then he has decided that he wants to go to Godric's Hollow, even though Hermione thinks this isn't a good idea, and it turns out to be a very bad idea. Uh-huh. But here we are, it's Harry, and he convinces her somehow that they should do it.
I got my forests mixed up. Forest of Dean doesn't have the tiny ponies, but it did have wild boar.
Oh.
So that would add some peril.
That Which
would.
Forest has the tiny ponies?
It is the New Forest, I think. It's the one near the Isle of Wight. If you...
The Old Forest has big
Okay,
ponies.
Next time I'm in town, you guys show me around. Yeah. And we'll ride
it's not
tiny
in a
ponies.
Town, it's a forest. Come on.
Yes. Come on, Shoes.
Next time I'm in forest. Show me around. And we'll eat ketchup-flavored Lay's and prawn-flavored Lay's.
We don't call them Lay's there. You're going to have to code switch
that. Those are things you can buy
that.
In London.
Yes, you can buy prawn flavored Walker's crisps.
Ketchup's the Canadian one, right? Prawn is definitely the London one.
Prawn cocktail, yeah. It tastes nothing like prawns, if that's any help.
I have had it. It's not bad. It's not like just shrimp strange.
Chips. It's just perverse.
It just feels weird to open a bag of chips with a shrimp on the cover.
Well, that's... Get over yourself.
Didn't know how to... You know what? Screw you.
You know what? I'll just eat my Marmite sandwich and be gone.
Right. I'm sure you've overcome more difficulties.
I have. Oh, so they go to Godric's Hollow. And something that bugs me, Jonas, in the books, there's this really cool thing where they pay more homage to Harry's parents in Godric's Hollow. There's a statue that from far away, I forget what it looks like, but when you get closer to the statue, it transforms and pays homage to Harry, James, and Lily. Okay. And it has a little plaque underneath. And then if you go to Harry's old house, as you get close to it, a thing pops up out of the ground and it's a little plaque and it tells you about the sacrifice that James and Lily made. And then there's like wholesome graffiti written all over it that's like, we love you, James and Lily.
Oh, they really love these.
We love you, Harry, and all this stuff, which it's really cool.
Yeah.
I think it's a fun moment. It did always confuse me why no one told Harry about this, because if it's a museum, you would think someone would be like, oh, yeah, I went to your parents' museum. It was super cool.
Yeah, I was like, they know he's alive, right?
Mm-hmm.
So why has he not gone there more often?
Exactly. So it was confusing. But at the same time, I'm sad that it wasn't in the movies because I wanted to see how they represented it, what they made all the stuff look like, etc. Yeah. So that's not there. They just go, they go to the graveyard, they see the graves, they see the Deathly Hallows sign written on one of them, and then they see Bathilda, who looks terrifying straight off the bat. They should have ran away immediately.
Yeah.
That first pan of her face, she looks like a snake pretending to be a human.
But how does the snake know how to move in a even remotely human way?
That always confused me, and I have no idea. I'm just going to chalk it up to Voldemort because he's really good at magic.
And is the implication that the Bathilda Bagshot who's been giving quotes to Rita Skeeter is just Nagini pissing around?
So the...
Does Rita Skeeter speak Parseltongue?
Probably.
Oh, maybe. The thought that the book at least unveils is that Rita Skeeter used Veritaserum to get it out of Bathilda because they find a note in the book that says, Bathilda, thanks for all the quotes, even if you didn't know what you said, or something creepy and ominous along those lines. Mm. So I guess the thought would be that was really Bathilda. And then at some point in time, they, I guess, killed Bathilda and then used her corpse for snake hiding purposes. Not really sure.
I just sort of assumed it was the snake with a disguise. Like, I kind of picture it as like Vincent Adamman in BoJack Horseman, like three kids stacked up on top of one another.
Yeah.
Yeah, but the snake's got two legs, two little legs.
Has it?
Yes.
Yeah.
So it's just inside her body and like fleshing out.
Her body is much too small for that enormous snake.
Right.
Well, it could curl
I'm
up.
Chalking this up to magic on this one.
Yeah, exactly.
Or the snake forms two legs with its body.
You
know, like a little zigzag thing going on.
Yeah, that's what I assumed.
Yeah.
But does that mean its like head is down one foot and its tail is down the other, so it's constantly like punching itself in the face as it's walking?
Oh, such a complex situation we've got.
I'm going to draw this out later.
They follow her around into the house, which is very creepy and dimly lit and dramatic, and they go through the photographs and all of this, and you learn about Grindelwald, etc.
It's nice of the snake to show them all this stuff, which is completely unnecessary for the snake to do.
Let me just give you some exposition.
The snake is really going method.
Well, it makes less sense in the movie, because in the book what happens is that Voldemort, once he knows that they've fallen into the trap, starts going back to Godric's Hollow and then attacks them. And in the movie, you're right, this doesn't make any fucking sense. Because why are they giving them clues about how to defeat Voldemort and who Grindelwald is and all this other stuff? So yeah, I think that this scene, they get the creepy factor of Bathilda spot on.
Yes.
They get the drama of the fight with the snake spot on, where it's attacking them, breaking through walls and stuff. But I think you lose the sheer intensity because a huge factor of this in the books is that Voldemort is on his way back. And there's even this weird scene where Harry starts going in and out of seeing himself versus the classic seeing through Voldemort's eyes things. And he can see himself from Voldemort approaching. And it's much higher stakes because not only do they have to get away from this giant snake that's about to murder them, but also, oh fuck, Voldemort's coming.
Yeah.
So I don't understand why they didn't put Voldemort in here. I feel like that, like, why would you put less Voldemort in the movie? He's the bad guy.
Yeah.
But he's off looking for other people to ruin.
Weirdly, he's like in the beginning of this movie, and then ever since he gets defeated by Harry when they're escaping, that's it, and he doesn't show up much again.
Yeah. He's just looking for the Elder Wand.
I guess.
Yeah.
I'm sure we could delegate some of that.
Yes. Send out the Death Eaters.
He's a micromanager, though. We've established that.
He probably just doesn't trust the Death Eaters right. enough to be like, take
yeah, these guys
Elder
aren't going to do it right. I got to look for it myself.
They're largely fuckwits, the Death Eaters, aren't they?
They are not great, but that's what happens when you're racist. You're bad at everything.
Exactly. Well, so he doesn't really give... He's not got a good management style. He doesn't give them space
He has a horrible management style. It's all about no positive reinforcement. It's all negative punishment.
It's all stick, exactly. No carrot. He doesn't give the... Like, he doesn't really talk to them about what they want for their futures and try and support them in their aspirations.
Not at all.
And
not
so
at
he's going to get shit people.
I recently just became a manager.
Congrats.
And I've done very well with like training, you know, whenever my employees do something great, I buy them coffee.
There you go.
I provide goods like chocolate or something that they enjoy and show my appreciation for them.
So if one of your employees doesn't meet your expectations at a performance review, do you get a snake to eat them?
No, I just belittle them in front of everyone and take their wand.
I think that's still a step ahead of Voldemort. So, you know, you're doing a great job.
I give them a small coffee.
Just an espresso for you.
No room for milk. Oh, Past Mike, look at you, talking about coffee as if you drink it. You don't drink coffee because you're a tiny baby boy and you don't like it. But you know what you do like? Keeping a roof over your head. So because of that, let's take a little bit of a break for Wingardium Adridosa. Today's episode of Potterless is brought to you by Shaker and Spoon. Let's say hypothetically that you are having a big party to celebrate finding a Horcrux, and you want to make sure that your drinks for this momentous occasion are fantastic and fancy and easy to put together because you're on the run. You don't have time to go to all these different stores to get the ingredients. How are you going to do this? You're going to do it with Shaker and Spoon. Shaker and Spoon will hook you up with a box of all of the different mix-ins and ingredients and instructions for making cocktails based on one liquor. All you need to do is provide one bottle of the liquor that goes with your ingredients box. They give you the ingredients to make four drinks of three different recipes, and they're so fun. They're always very different, which is nice. You can get a lot of versatility out of the same bottle of liquor. And you make these drinks, you keep the instruction cards forever so you can make it in the future. Everyone at your party thinks you're fancy, and then you can just make them for yourself if you want to have a fancy Wednesday afternoon. Who's to stop you from making it? No one. I'm not your dad. I've loved every single box that I've had from Shaker and Spoon, whether I've got them for myself, or my friends have gotten them, or we've had some events at the Multitudio where they've sponsored it and given us a box to use. It's always fantastic. It's really great. I cannot recommend it highly enough. And if this sounds interesting to you, you can save some money as a Potterless listener. If you go to shakerandspoon.com/Potterless, you'll get $20 off your first box, which is about half off. The boxes are between $40 and $50, depending on what you get. And all you got to do to get that savings is go to shakerandspoon.com/Potterless. So go to shakerandspoon.com/Potterless, save $20, get fancy drinks delivered to you, and have a wonderful celebration party for finding Horcruxes today. And now you'll hear words from a few sponsors who make it feasible for me to be a full-time podcaster. Some of these ads will be read by me, others of them won't. The ones that aren't are inserted locally, so if you live internationally, don't be surprised if you hear an ad in your country's native language. And once those ads are complete, we'll get back to this episode of Potterless. So, ultimately, I just think the snake fight has lower stakes. The other thing they change is that Harry's wand doesn't get broken by them falling on it. In the books, Hermione or Harry, one of them falls on the wand and it breaks, which is, I think, more crushing because it's such a simple way for the wand to break. Mm. So Hermione gets them out of there.
But that's what we discussed is that's how easy it could be.
Right. And I think that's actually a really interesting thing when it happens in the book is, oh yeah, that could happen so easily. Yeah. Whereas I think the explanation in the movie is that there's a rebounding spell and it destroys Harry's wand, which doesn't seem like it makes as much sense to me. Mm. So Harry's all upset about the wand being broken.
Of course.
It's sitting out all moody. And then the doe comes along and he follows it, shows him where the sword is. He dives in. This whole scene, I think, is done very well.
Mm.
The drama of swimming and getting trapped under the ice. Mm. The shots were really cool. The shots where Ron comes and takes him out is really cool. You get the first person view of Harry when he comes to. I think is really great. But there's one thing that didn't make any sense is that when Harry approaches the ice and he sees the sword, the way that the lake is set up is it's a bit winding. And rather than spend the least amount of time possible on the ice and go to the grass part right towards the middle,
yeah.
Harry takes an S curve that goes along as much ice as possible before getting to where the sword is, which I've never walked on a lake, but I feel like I would be afraid that it would crack at any moment.
I mean, it's making those sounds of like, this yeah. could burst at any moment.
It just feels like you would want to not spend a lot of time on the ice. And then the other thing that does make sense is when he does the Defendo to break a little hole to get the sword, he doesn't break a very big hole in the ice. So then when he's getting trapped under the ice, it's like, you buffoon,
yeah.
you should have broken more ice.
Exactly.
I think there's a real problem with splitting the book up into two films in this scene, because in the book, you find out where the Patronus came from, why the sword was there, all of that stuff. But if you just watch this film, you're just like, what? Why is it there? Like,
yeah.
how did someone find him to send the Patronus? Who
That's
was the
why this is part one.
Yeah.
But it's really unsatisfying because you get to the end and you're just like, did they just, like, is that just meant to be a deus ex machina? Or will we find out what happened? And you don't know. At the end of the film, you're left with all these questions of like, was that on purpose or was that just deliberately confusing?
And yeah. there's no like knowledge of you maybe finding out in the next movie.
That is true. There's no hint or wondering. They don't even make it obvious with them being like, where did the dough come from?
Yeah.
It's just Harry saying, did you send that? And Ron goes, no, I thought it was yours. And Harry says, no, mine's a stag. And Ron goes, ah, yes, antlers. And that's it.
That's quite sweet.
When I saw him dive into the water to get the sword of Gryffindor, it didn't seem like it was that far away either. It felt like he could have just jumped once and then just not even swim towards it. He could just dive right in and grabbed it.
I think part of it is that the water's supposed to be so cold that swimming in it is probably really taxing.
Yeah.
That's the vibe that I kind of got. But yeah, it didn't seem incredibly deep.
Yeah.
Can they not do some magic so that they don't get hypothermia when they get out, or that he doesn't
think.
Like die of shock upon getting into this frozen lake?
They do have a drying spell. I don't know why Harry didn't use it, because Dumbledore used it before in book six.
I think he doesn't necessarily think come up with these things until later.
Yeah. The spell that Harry used to get the ointment for Ron's arm
he used Accio.
Couldn't he just do that with a sword?
He tried to do it with the sword, okay. And it didn't work.
Okay.
Usually with Accio, you can't use it for very powerful objects,
okay.
is the general yeah. vibe that happens. You're supposed to be able to use it for little things like Accio keys or Accio wallet, but not Accio, the sword of Gryffindor.
Yeah. Accio death stick.
Why did he go swimming wearing the pendant? That could come off.
That
and
was
then
the
also
stupidest
obviously it tries
shit.
To kill him.
I mean, the whole reason is so that you get the plot device, but that makes no sense at all. Take that thing off, Harry, you idiot.
Yes.
I did really like that, though, the fact that he was about to get killed by a neck. I mean, that would just have been such a sad end of like, I survived Voldemort and was killed by a necklace.
I was killed by stainless steel painted
Every
gold.
Kill begins with K. That's a, I don't know if you guys have K in the UK.
The UK. K Jewelers is a brand of jewelers that has a theme song, right. Every Kiss Begins
and
with K.
And their motto is Every Kiss Begins with K.
Oh, okay.
They're good at spelling.
We don't have that.
Well, you should get your overpriced jewelry at K Jewelers. It's low quality and overpriced.
Potterless this week is brought to you by...
It's brought to you by... It's by Jared. They paid me to shit talk K Jewelers.
That's such a weird name for a jewelry company.
He went to Jared.
Yeah, it just makes me think of Jared the Subway guy, which doesn't seem to be...
He's
like
ruined an entire first
reference.
Name.
Mm.
So Ron comes, saves him, then they decide to destroy the Horcrux. And I have to say that I love, once they open the Horcrux, how quickly and how intensely it goes from, this locket is closed, to, the world is ending.
Yeah.
It goes 0 to 100 real quick, yes. And I love it. It was so cool. The visual effects of this were awesome.
Yes.
I don't know if you have any VFX takeaways from it, but just watching it looked so cool.
Yeah. This, you know, I could tell you right now, that shot alone, a frame of it probably took like 14 hours to make.
Whoa.
For one frame. It's a lot of fluid work, and I've done little fluid work before on a shot before, and it took forever to render. It's so much information, but it comes out so beautiful if you do it correctly.
It's a really good monster. It's like this kind of abstract column of oily smoke, and it's a really good adversary. I don't know, in the books, like, do they have to go through this stuff? Do they have to like fight the bit of soul, or do they just like smack it with the sword?
They do. It's a little less giant smoke monster-esque. What really happens is you open it and then there's the Voldemort eyes, and then you do still get that voice trying to manipulate Ron, and you do get the little Harry and Hermione kissing each other kind of thing. Stuff all still happens. They don't clarify being naked in the book. That was a movie flare. But you do get some of that stuff, and then Ron has to attack it with the sword.
Would have been way worse if you just see Harry and Hermione just doing the dance.
Yeah, doing the awkward dance naked is the only thing that can make that scene worse.
And you see Ron go, no!
I thought all of the effect was good. I think that the creepy Harry and Hermione are really well done.
Yeah.
But also because their faces look face-tuned.
Yeah.
Where it looks even...
Oh, yeah.
It looks so unsettling. They're unsettlingly perfect. It's weird. But I love it.
Yeah, they've got a kind of like Korean Instagram filter vibe.
Yeah. So Ron ends up destroying the Horcrux. I always found it interesting that he doesn't attack it with the sharp edge or the pointy edge. He kind of just slaps it with the blunt end of the sword. And that breaks it. But hey, well, if it works, it works.
Get as much coverage as he can.
Yeah, the thing I like about this scene is that like this is the first time, well, it's the first time I can remember these two boys like sorting shit out without Hermione having to step in and going like,
I know how
this works. Like, they actually do something for once in the film, which is really nice.
Finally productive.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's good. And the voice that happened the whole time for the locket is so creepy. The, I've seen your failures, Ron Weasley. Ugh. It's so good.
Oh, it's like anxiety, isn't it?
Yeah.
That locket?
Pretty much. It's playing on Ron's insecurities.
You're a shit person. Everyone hates you.
Your mom likes Harry better than you.
It's a bit basic, though, isn't it? It's like your friend wants to shag your girlfriend.
Yeah, but when it says, you're not your favorite of your mother's many children, like, everyone knows Molly Weasley would play fair.
Yeah.
Locket and really, then, like, biffed that one.
One step further, if your mother admitted she would have preferred to have Harry as a son than you. That one cuts deep.
Yeah.
That's clearly not true. Molly's such a nice mum.
I would have preferred to have Harry as a son instead of you, because then he couldn't marry Ginny. Better idea.
They defeat it. They go back. And I love the difference, the dichotomy between Ron being so happy and accomplished and thinking that Hermione's going to be happy to see him and her being so upset at Ron. Yeah. Oh, I loved it. It was so fun.
I love the moment where she's like, where's my wand? And Harry's like, I don't know.
What's her justification, really? It felt a bit over the top.
He just fucked off and abandoned them.
Yeah.
That was ages ago.
Kind of when they needed his help, you know?
Yeah, but then he saved Harry from, like, getting choked to death in a frozen pond.
She didn't know that, though.
Yeah, she's had a tough week.
Maybe she's one of these people where it's like, you know, some people respond to, like, one big gesture, and other people, it's like lots of little gestures is their love language.
There's also, like, a moment where she's like, where did you get the Sword of Gryffindor? So it could have been a moment where she goes, were you hiding this from us the whole time? Like, you knew where the Sword of Gryffindor was, and then you're just now telling us?
I was using it to make sandwiches.
I saw it on QVC. I purchased it. That's how I got it.
But look at this can I cut through.
So then you have the scene of Ron and Harry together with the other wand that Ron has picked up from the Snatcher. And I like the way they did this scene in the movie better than the book. In the book, you have Harry playing around with this wand, and it's not exactly right. He tries to do in Gorgio on a spider that's on a bush, and it gets way too big, and Ron gets mad at him for it. But I loved the comedy of the little flame and he does in Gorgio, and it's way too big. He's like, "Rah, dah, dah!" And then Hermione's like, "What's going on in there?" "Nothing." It was really funny. I thought it was good.
That's a really nice moment, actually. Yeah, I did like that.
It was just such a quick, silly little scene. And it's funny, Martin, like you said before, one scene ago is the only time they were competent together without Hermione. And 15 seconds later, they're back to being a bunch of bumbling idiots.
Yeah.
And they're just like, quick, don't let Hermione realize we can't do stuff without her. Like, we were doing so well.
It's like when my generally domestically very incompetent dad was left in charge of us kids when my mom was in hospital for 2 weeks. Turns out he can cook and launder. No. Until she came back, not at all.
Mm-hmm. So that seems really fun. And then you get a really cool scene in the movie is when they do the animation of the three brothers story.
Yes.
In the Beetle the Bard.
Yes, that's beautiful.
Yeah, I like that.
So gorgeous. It's so cool.
I think that's a very iconic scene.
100%.
I've seen it even done at the...
They do it at Universal with the
Universal
puppets.
And it's just as beautiful.
Yeah.
The story is being told very well. From an animator perspective as well, it just seems like So it felt real too.
Yeah.
It didn't feel like it was an animation. It felt like it was puppetry.
It just fits, which is so interesting. I remember when I was first reading the books and I hadn't seen this movie, people were telling me, oh, the way they do the three brothers scene is really cool. It's animated. And I thought, it's animated?
Yeah.
How are you going to make that seamlessly fit into a Harry Potter movie? And this works really well.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know how to describe it other than that it doesn't feel out of place, which is really cool. I really enjoyed that scene. No complaints about that.
Yeah.
I think it's iconic. It's wonderful. So after this, they go to meet up with Xenophilius to try to ask about the Deathly Hallows symbol. And they change this scene a bunch. There's a bit more drawn out about where's Luna and Xenophilius stalling and it being more apparent that he's trying to get people to come get Harry. Mm. And then what does make sense the way they do it in the movie is just when it is revealed that he was just trying to hold them there so that the Death Eaters could attack Harry. Mm-hmm. The Death Eaters just fly around and shoot vague sparks at Xenophilius' house and then make it crumble, whereas in the book, two people actually show up and try to get Harry.
Yeah.
And Hermione does a creative workaround for them to escape out of there and all this stuff. And in the movie, it's just, oh, we're destroying the house. Let's leave. Just they really reduced this to almost a nothing scene.
Yeah.
And I didn't find it very interesting. It made me sad.
It did annoy me the first time until I realized what was happening. When he was drawing the symbols of the Deathly Hallows, he drew them really, really slowly.
Mm.
And but then when you figure he's stalling, he's like, oh, wow, I've got to wait till the Death Eaters to get here. I'm going to draw a circle as slowly as humanly possible. Now I'm going to draw a triangle as slowly as they're not difficult shapes to draw.
What was funny about how long it took him to draw the shapes is that when he was done drawing them, I thought, this didn't turn out too pretty. He took a really long time to make that circle, and it's a below average.
Well, sometimes you've just got to go with your gut feeling, you know, just get it out there as quickly as possible, right?
Or just get some rulers and a protractor.
Yeah.
And, you know, really make sure it works out well. Get your compass, make a perfect circle. They then have the scene afterwards where they're running away from the Snatchers. And the best part about this, and it might be the best part of the whole movie and the entire film franchise, is when one of the Snatchers says to the rest of the Snatchers, snatch him.
Snatch him, Snatchers.
I was like, well, go on, snatch him.
Like, we are Snatchers. We are supposed to snatch. Why are you Snatchers not snatching?
They even let Ron run past him.
Oh, gosh. The fact that they just use the word snatch, fantastic.
Do Americans know what the word snatch means in British English?
Just to steal?
No, it's the...
It's one of the meanings.
There's a noun.
Vaginal area. As well.
Oh, yes. No.
So when that Guy Ritchie film Snatch came out a few years ago, everyone was like, oh, God.
Yeah.
Was Nick Moran also in that?
I think Nick Moran was probably in that, yeah. Brad Pitt was in it?
Yes, Brad Pitt was in that.
You know, during his British period.
So then you've got a couple more scenes before we round this out. You've got the Voldemort vision of finding out where the Elder Wand is because he interrogates Grindelwald. Again, this one's done really quickly in the movie, and in the book there's more of Grindelwald admitting to Voldemort that he's messed up and all of that. And I don't think Grindelwald in the book gives up the location of it. I'm not exactly sure, but I feel like they changed it up here. But it's really not that important because they're clearly not focusing on this in the movie, which is fine.
Well, I guess Voldemort in the book, does he just figure out that because he's been defeated by Dumbledore?
I think Voldemort figures it out on his own because Grindelwald says he doesn't have it.
Whereas here, because you don't have all of that backstory in the film at this point.
I guess that's why they did it. Yeah, because you don't know in the book that Dumbledore defeated Grindelwald in a duel.
Yeah.
So you wouldn't know.
You don't know that in the film. I think you know that in the book.
Yes, though, right? Exactly. You don't know it in the movie, so they have to find another way to explain it. So then you've got the squad getting caught. And the way that they get caught is different because it's just them showing up, basically, and getting them. Whereas in the book, it's the whole thing where you finally learn why saying Voldemort's name is bad because it's part of the trace thing. So, Jonas, they have a thing where they're listening to Pottercast. Uh-huh. Or no, they're listening to Potterwatch. And
they listen to Potterless.
They're listening to Potterless. And they're like, well, gosh, why does this guy not know how old Harry is in Goblet of Fire? So they're listening to Potterwatch. Fuck. They're listening to Potterwatch. And
listening to Potter thing.
They're listening to Potterwatch. And at one point, Harry out loud says Voldemort and says his full name, and then all of the Death Eaters swarm to where he is, and then they catch him. And then Hermione does the transfigure thing, etc.
Okay.
So then from that point, it's the same. Yes. Shoots him in the face, makes him look all different. And then they take them into be with the Death Eaters at the Malfoy Manor.
Yeah.
A slight difference. Fenrir Greyback is the one that is supposed to figure out that it's Harry, and it's some other snatcher that does it. So they bring them in, and then this scene, I think, actually is, they changed some stuff, but I think it's still done very well with the Draco clearly knowing it's Harry, but deciding
that how he's could you not know it was Harry?
He totally does. Yeah. And this was never believable, but I still think that the way they conveyed in the film matches the way it's in the book, where Draco knows, but he's, for whatever reason, decided not to
tell. I feel like Bellatrix should have been like, no, that is Harry Potter.
She hasn't seen him that much, has she? Has she?
They have posters.
He doesn't have his glasses on. It's Clark Kent. Yeah, he's reverse Clark Kent.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, people that wear glasses and they take them off, they do look different.
So the part that I think is really good, though, Bellatrix being creepy, torturing, evil Bellatrix is unreal. Helena Bonham Carter absolutely kills it here. She's legitimately terrifying.
Yeah.
And when she's all on top of Hermione laying on the ground and she's crying and stuff, oh my gosh.
Yeah, that's pretty good.
Oh, it's so good.
Yeah.
It's very BDSM, like, especially where the way she kind of like attacks the Watchers, where she's kind of got them like around the neck with collars and stuff.
Yeah, with the whip of sorts. Yeah. In the scene, they take Harry and Ron down to the dungeon and they leave Hermione up to be tortured by Bellatrix. And the way they do this dungeon thing is a little bit different. First off, there's no Dean Thomas there. It's just Luna and
Ollivander.
Griphook and Ollivander. And also, unfortunately, they changed the way that Pettigrew dies. They don't do the...
This is really upsetting that they've made such an enormous shift from the book.
Their deaths are all so fast. Deaths are fast in this movie.
You could wank yourself to death quickly.
So what happens in the book, Jonas, is that he's got this metal hand that Voldemort gave him, right?
And he fingers himself to death.
Martin!
He's got this metal hand, and he is attacking Harry and Ron with it, and Harry is trying to convince Pettigrew to not be evil against them. Exactly. He's saying, I saved you, I spared your life. Don't you remember? Didn't you read the third book? I spared your life. And he has a brief moment with because I think he's grabbing Harry with the metal hand, and he has a brief moment where he releases for a second and then tries to go back, but then the hand turns against him and chokes him to death, or as Helen and Martin believe, masturbated himself to death.
I mean, erotic, what is it?
Autoerotic asphyxiation.
That's the word.
There's the one. But
it's just this amazing moment in the book. Like, it's such a like,
it's actually
bizarre
really,
death.
It's such a strange, abrupt, evil death. And again, it just shows you, Voldemort's got some powerful magic going on.
But
if
in this
make
one, in the movie, you get badass moment from good boy Dobby.
You do, also still in the book. But the way that they get rid of Pettigrew is he just gets a spell in his back that knocks him out, and it's supposed to be slapstick comedy-esque, and it makes me sad. So
He just wait. Does he come back in the final film?
So is he not dead or is he dead?
I don't think he died.
Okay.
Pettigrew.
Yeah.
No, he's just like flat on his back on the stairs, isn't he?
I felt like I did see a little blood splatter on the wall, but I was unsure.
I don't think he died.
No, because that was Dobby, wasn't it, who sucked him in the back?
Right.
So Dobby wouldn't have killed him. Not on purpose.
Dobby's too good of a boy.
He's a good boy.
So they go up and then they start having the fight against Bellatrix and Draco and Dobby in the mix. And this is done really well.
Yes.
Pretty accurate to the book with the chandelier falling and overtaking Draco for the wands. I don't remember in the movie. Does Harry do the triple stupefy with three wands in this?
He's got at least two, I think.
Yeah. Okay. In the book, he at one point has three wands. and he does stupefy with all three at the same time.
Jesus.
And it does a superfy, if you will. And I always imagined that he had one in between each of the crevices. Yeah, crevices between his finger, Wolverine style. And he's stupefy.
Well, he does do that. And whoever he uses it against like gets blasted across the room.
I want to say it was the Malfoys.
Yeah.
So that guy is like thrown 20 feet across the room.
Love it. I love that if you have more than one wand, it's just multiplication of the spell. Yeah. It's additive.
Why don't they just all have like a bunch of wands then?
That's a thing. General Grievous of Wands. Just have a bunch. You should be actively trying to gather as many wands as you can.
Or you could just gaffer tape one onto each finger, like Edward right? Scissorhands.
Edward, yeah, just do Avada Kedavra 10 times at once.
Edward Wand Hands.
There it is. Then you get the very dramatic scene where Bellatrix throws the knife. I think the camera work and the way that they do it in the movie is really cool, where it's slowly end over end flying through the sky into them apparating. And then, crushing, you get the Dobby death.
Well, it's not just the death, but it's the Dobby standing up for himself right before it happens, where he's just like, Dobby is a free elf, you dick.
Yeah, Dobby has no master.
In that moment, you actually, when you see Dobby like stand up for himself, he even looks stronger.
Yeah.
It was just like beautiful.
I mean, Dobby's kind of swole, is chill. He's like toned.
He is toned, very. And then like just... You see him, he's like, Dobby will save Harry Potter and his friends. And it's so good.
It's really solid.
Yeah.
Goes out like a champ. But yeah, then unfortunately, Dobby's dead. They change his final words here. In the movies, Dobby's final words are, such a beautiful place to be with friends. Dobby is happy to be with his friend, Harry Potter. But in
the book.
In the book. I think he just says Harry Potter.
Yeah.
Harry Potter.
Also, there's I know Harry's upset, but this scene also demonstrates how little Harry actually knows about magic. Because he's just like, Hermione, haven't you got something in your bag? Like, what?
I feel like he's just in that moment of just
desperate.
Like, he wants something to help. It's like that bargaining stage of death where you're just like, someone gets shot and you're just like, do something, anyone help me.
No, maybe you're right. Maybe I'm being a bit unfair on Harry Potter. And this I do like the fact that when we talked about the book, like he goes off and buries him on his own. I'm going to do it the proper way, the non-magic way. He goes off on his own and buries Dobby. And I was just like, why is he like separating himself? And I like the fact that in this scene, like they do it together.
Yeah.
And it feels like they're all kind of honoring Dobby and he's with his friends, kind of grieving together. He's not off on his own being like a tough guy.
Yeah.
It's a much nicer reading this. And also the location is like, it's like in a field in the book, I think. And here it's like this beautiful beach.
Yeah, in the book, I think they're still near some sort of body of water, but it's not a straight up beach.
I feel like that's a weird place to bury him because it could easily be like a road.
Oh, I guess.
Yeah, so. I did think
well,
that.
It depends on the integrity of the dunes.
Yes.
I've Googled it, and in the book, Dobby's final words are, Dobby is happy to be with his friend, Harry Potter.
Oh, okay.
And
then he his passes. Friend.
So just a little bit reduced. But if you look at his first and last words, his first word is Harry, and his last word is Potter. Ooh, deep, deep, deep.
It's like an acrostic.
Aha! It's a very poetic wording of Dobby. So yeah, they bury him. They're all sad, and that's the end of that. But then you get one little extra scene where Voldemort very creepily breaks into Dumbledore's tomb, which doesn't make any sense because in the sixth movie, they never show Dumbledore's funeral, which has his tomb being outside of the school.
Mm.
And in the movie, it's just in the middle of some forest that they don't explain.
A tiny island.
It's like this island forest with this weird tomb. And he just breaks in, takes the wand, and then...
Isn't it down by the edge of the lake that's at Hogwarts, but the camera's got its back to the school?
I guess that's the assumption. Like, it's near the boathouse or something.
But also... I found Dumbledore's tomb to be a lot more modern in design than any house or product that we've seen.
I mean,
if
we know anything about Dumbledore, he is very modern in design.
It's the only thing that has like design cues from post-1972.
Lovely bit of brutalism.
It's incredibly postmodern. It felt very out of place.
But beautiful.
I liked it.
It is beautiful, but it doesn't feel like what Dumbledore would be rocking in his tomb.
I suppose it is kind of a call forward to the King's Cross all in white scene towards the end of the book.
Oh, I could see it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But that is the end of the movie. And that's the end of this episode and all of our discussion about the seventh movie, Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows Part 1. So
next, Part 4.
No, gosh. It's 1 a.m. We have to stop this madness.
This film will never end. Like the camping trip, it will never end.
It's one of, if not the shortest movie, but we talked about it so much. How do you guys feel in general about this movie, just as a whole?
I like it. I don't know whether it's good.
I didn't love a lot of the plot parts of this. And I don't know whether it was because I don't love the book or I don't love the way that they've adapted the material, but I did like kind of the way it looked. I liked how much location stuff there was, the forests.
I definitely had seen
the London
it.
Street scenes, all of that stuff.
I'd seen it when it came out and I remembered absolutely fuck all from it.
I recognize this as a film.
Definitely a film.
I know. I thought it was great. I thought with the beginning movies, they were not my favorite, but as the movies got on and more mature, it kind of caught my eye a little bit more. I was never a fan of Harry Potter. For the longest time, I was like, I'm never going to watch the Harry Potter movies. I'm never going to read the books. And then I met a girl. And then, of course, I was like, I'll watch Harry Potter.
Oh, same.
Through your sleeping eyes.
It really caught my eye with this movie, just because it's all that anticipation and the whole running around aspect of it kept me on the edge of my seat, basically.
Yeah, I really like the movie. I think of all of the Harry Potter movies, this one's my favorite. And it might just be because this one was the truest to the source material. And that's always what bugs me the most about the movies is when they change stuff up.
Well, I thought in the fifth one, it was really great they changed stuff up because that book dragged.
Yeah, they did have some significant improvements there.
Yeah, because they could take liberties with the material because the source material was not that strong.
But what I liked about this one, I think it's the rare case where you get more into the emotions behind the characters and their decisions and why they feel the way that they feel, and more so than the other movies where they're kind of just going through the motions and hitting the check marks of this has to happen and then this has to happen and plot, 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 plot. Mm. I enjoyed that this one you get a little more of the animosity that Ron has at certain instances, or the despair of not being able to find what they're looking for, all this other stuff. I think you actually start to get more into the emotion of the characters, which is always, to me, one of the more compelling parts of the series. So I like that actually came through in this movie.
Yeah. As I said, I think some of that feels a little contrived, like especially with the Locket stuff with Ron. But
yeah,
what I did like is the sort of sense of like isolation and like the sense that they were losing the war. And there's that really good scene where they're hearing the list, the radio announcers like, oh, luckily we don't have many deaths to announce today. And then they announce this huge list of like wizards that have died. And you're just like, oh, wow, they're really losing this war against Voldemort.
Yeah.
And that sense of like, do they really stand a chance? There's a few scenes like in the Ministry of Magic where they like, you know, they're doing pretty well. And then there's a lot of scenes where they're just on the run or just desperately trying to figure out how they're going to find the Horcruxes, how can they even destroy the Horcruxes and stuff like that. And that felt really good. Like they were like, is there a light at the end of this tunnel for these characters? And I thought that was really well rendered.
Yeah. I like that this movie was okay with not having a happy ending too. Some of the other movies in the series, they try to force a happy ending. And I like that this one was just, shit sucks, guy. Wait till the movie
ends. Yeah.
Well, because this one doesn't have an ending, really.
Right.
Because it's an incomplete act structure.
Also, some of this, like, the movies allow them to just cover stuff so much faster. Like, I remember when we talked about the whole thing at the Malfoy Manor. And that seemed like quite an involved chapter. And whereas in this, they just whip through it.
Yeah, it's like 10 minutes max.
But it works much better in the film version because it's just like, you don't need them having like a long conversation about like Gringotts in the, or whatever it is they have in the dungeon. You just kind of want like the peril of Hermione being in danger and then the action scene and then getting to Dobby's death, which is sad. But that's the important point of the outcome of that scene, that Dobby's killed. And they just get to it really quickly and it feels exciting and sad and dangerous and all of that stuff. It works really well.
Yeah.
If they could have just killed Dobby in the first minute of the film, Martin, and then just taken the rest of the day off.
I don't think that's going to be a popular opinion.
Well, everyone, thank you so much for joining on. This has been a fun, thorough explanation of this movie. But I'm happy because this is one of my favorite movies and I was joined by some of my favorite people. So, Jonas, if people want to find you on the internet, where can they find you?
Yeah, you guys can find me at JonasDDraws with a Z at the end on all social medias. You can also find my podcast, Rough Night Movie Podcast, and The Universe According to Rex and Jonas. We do have an episode with Shubes on each of those podcasts. So please go listen to those, especially the Rough Night Movie Podcast one, because that's a... It was a kind of a shit show because we watched two different movies by accident.
It was great. Yeah. It was wonderful. It was a good time.
Yeah.
How long did it take you to realize that you'd watched different ones?
The day that we started recording.
Yep. It was great. We're 5 minutes in. We're like, uh-oh. But we made it work because we're consummate professionals.
Yeah, we are.
Helena Martin, what about if people want to find you?
Well, I'm Helen Zaltzman on the major platforms. That's with two Z's. Good luck with working that out. No more, no less. And you can hear my podcast, The Allusionist, Veronica Mars Investigations, and Answer Me This.
And I'm on Twitter at Martin Austwick. Also, good luck spelling that. And you can find my music at palebirdmusic.com. And I do a podcast about the music of Tom Waits, almost like a recap show, but song by song. And it's called Song by Song, and you can find it at songbysongpodcast.com.
Great. And if you guys need to spell any of these things, just look at the episode you're listening to, because I've typed it out.
Much appreciated.
Still, people manage to spell Shubes without a C, which baffles me every day.
I don't know how they do that.
Disgusting.
It's written everywhere. I don't understand. But
the composer Schubert never got that.
It's very disrespectful.
Franz Schubert's the most famous Schubert, and he spelled it with a C. I know those idiots over at the Schubert Theater in New York spell it without a C, but those heathens can get out of there and charge too much for a ticket price.
Can I just say one thing?
Yes.
I want to say that I'm very proud of you for this podcast. I've known Shoes for so long. And I remember when I first met him, we knew each other from Vine. And he was like, hey, I'm from Houston. We should hang out sometime. I was like, hey, I'm going to this art show. And he made this Vine of meeting me for the first time where he was very nervous and stuff. And I really appreciate it to this day. But he's doing bigger and better things. And I really enjoy everything that he does right now.
My dude, thanks, man. You're warming my heart right now.
No problem, man.
And here's your $50. Thank you so much. But everyone, thanks so much for joining. Listeners, thank you so much for listening. As they say in the Wizarding World of Harry Potter, before they mop up tears off the ground after their friend says something really heartfelt for them as they finish recording their podcast episode, a wizard on!
Wizard on!
Okay.
Martin, press stop.
Hey, if this podcast is over and you don't have anything else in your app to listen to, might I recommend some Multitude shows? There's so many fantastic podcasts out there from Multitude, and you should check them out. Horse, the basketball show that I work on. We have so many lovely episodes. We just did an episode talking about the Kobe situation, which definitely affected me and a lot of people. It was one of the more challenging things that I've done in a podcast, but I was very happy with the way Eric and I did it, and then the rest of the episode was still very fun. Spirits, their hometown urban legends episodes never fail to make me laugh. Their December edition, The Bathroom is a Ghost, fantastic. Join the Party just wrapped up their first season. If you love binging through shows, you should start from episode 1 of season 1, because then you can just binge the entire story and you never have to wait. It's all there. What's not to love? So if you want to find any and all of these shows, just search Multitude in Spotify or any of your other preferred podcasting apps. Potterus is created by Mike Schubert. It is hosted by Mike Schubert. It is edited by Mike Schubert. It is produced by Mike Schubert, as well as Vicky Garcia, Aaron Johnson, Jesse Horgan, Klauser, Lopu, Marchismo, Samantha Rose, Juan Sanfilio, Rosemary Dodge, Marie Lisa C. Keen, Romina Rivadeneer, Audra, Eleanor Curlin, Ross Ann Batamana, Nikita Power, Ali Madsen, Amelia Krauss, Sarah Nink, Ben Silver, Rachel Guthrie, Zachary Polito, Orchid Grower, Vivian the Owl, Takari Ront, Haley Hastings, Moster, Ingen Oddstadter, Alex Consilver, John Codker, Noel Basile, Emily Tyrell, Liz Bigelow, Brandon Pickens, Sarah Anson, Claire Spencer, Rory Collier, Gloria Gillum, Veronica Bartova, Lada Bartova, Noah, Tracy Toya, Colleen, Jennifer Marklu, Friday J. Sven, Ivor Peterson, Naomi Guglielmo, Summer Rathel, Andrea Kroc, Lynn Walker, Justin Montero, Christine Saunders, Jacob Parrish, Toothless Walnut, Maya Gray, Mark Boddy, Polly Burge, Ned Atabani, Zena Rosnowski, Harlan Haskins, Noelia Addy, Nikki Harris, Kine, Amanda Alford, Alicia McLaren, Kafir Shaltiel, Lindy Plackey, Sarah Shetter, Marta Morrison, Aaron Richter, Eileen Gazesh, Violet Sullivan, Lindsay Towning, Keegan Curran, Miranda Manning, Gail Ann, Mr. Folk, Maya, Kieran, Lily Leader Williams, Wire Warrior 4976, Floor Sake, Siri Scars, Ford, Georgia, Peter Wyckoff, Skyla Lily, Edel Ryan, Professor Threat, Ellie Hoskov Chova, Daniel Fulkerson, Lee Lily, Elizabeth Christopher, and Michael David Yordi, Tiffany Cottrell, Kelly O'Till, Carrie Krempler, Connie Bienkowski, Mary Mateel, Jennifer Wendt, Jaden Allman, Nedry OS, Will Huser, Samantha Lentz, Kayla M. Simino, Aurora Fruhoff, Emma Clark, Out of Context 69, Marco Cepeda, Hannah Zeters, Courtney Spilker, Victoria McCormick, Marika Rieger, Ashton Gabrielson, Brittany Gutierrez, Phelan, Julie Walton, The Meadows Family, Ginny from the Block, Anna Penalber Alvarez, Fake Valentine, Brianna Jordan, Jenny, Sarah Saunders, McKenna Tweedy, Mary Joy Moa, Heather, Weekend of Dead Cat Ladies, Javi Guadalupe, Trejo III, Darlene Kerr, Brad Harding, Thomas Chavara, Charlotte, Brianna Cusimano, Kevin Stewart, Laurie McDonald, Chrissy Tew, Bugaboo, Jarl Sviven, Haley Logan, Emma, Ashley Enstrom, Peter McGrath, Sophie Duda, Jack McMahon, Jen and Rose Daub, Nicole Linzer, Callahan and Daris, Kylo the Husky, Leah Reed, Melissa Robb, Jordy Wright, Bella Barlack, Melanie Demi, Bill Gill, Victoria Colca Perry, Joe Radwan, Elizabeth Yu, Britt McLean, Molly Bautista, Becca Spry, Anthony Rees Dignan, Adam Graham, Joseph Torp, Courtney Harris, T Run Money, Madison Kyle, Don't Call Me Nymphadora, G, Sabrina Balsiger, Sophia Loves Pigs, Farzan Jarabot, Melanie DeGrief, David Douglas, Maria Matt Barger, Okami Hime, Steamed Nuggets, and Can't I Potter? Web design by Kelly Beckman, and the music is by Patina Campamanas. If you want to find us on social media, you can at facebook.com/potterless, twitter.com/potterlesspod, instagram.com/potterlesspodcast, and reddit.com/r/potterless. For any and all information about the show, you can go to potterlesspodcast.com. For bonus content, you can go to patreon.com/potterless, and for merch, you can go to potterlesspodcast.com/merch. If you want to tell someone about the show, whether it's online, through a review, or in person, that really helps a ton. Thanks so much for listening, and until next time, as they say in the Wizarding World of Harry Potter, Wizard on!